This week on Texas Scorecard Radio in the news, we've got a disgraced congressman returning to the taxpayer trough. We've got Harris County using a disaster to rush to raise debt. And we'll hear about how Austin is making its affordability crisis even worse. In our interview, I sit down with Brandon Waltons and do a deep dive on whether the Democrats will hold on to their obstructionist coalition in the Texas House. And finally, what is a Texan? Carrie Cheshire explores that in this week's commentary. Welcome back to another week of Texas Scorecard Radio, broadcasting from the 1836 studios. I'm your host, Tony McDonald. We'll get started this week with this week's news. I have Empire Texans President Michael Quinn Sullivan in the studio. Texas has its newest tax-funded lobbyist, former Congressman Blake Farenthold, getting a taxpayer-funded job right out of the gate. Tell us about it.
Yeah, you know, congratulations to Blake Farenthold. A lot of us wondered what was going to happen to him after he resigned in disgrace. You know, folks will remember that Blake Farenthold is the congressman from Corpus Christi, last seen being photographed in ducky pajamas with scantily clad women on his arm. Well, it turns out that he had to resign in disgrace because he had used taxpayer money, about $85,000 in taxpayer money, to settle a big surprise sexual harassment lawsuit.
Right.
So there was this question: what's going to happen to him? You had Governor Abbott, you had pundits from Republican, centrist, liberal, everyone agreeing, Blake Farenthold from Washington, D.C. to Austin, everywhere in between, that he needed to repay the taxpayers.
That's right.
The $85,000. And so while all this is brewing out there, we have just now recently learned that Blake Farenthold has, as you mentioned, a new gig. He is going to be the tax-funded lobbyist for the Port of Port Lavaca, which is run by the Calhoun Port Authority. Now, this is one of those many layers of government entities that you know nothing
forget
about.
Forget exist. Yeah.
You don't even know they exist. They sit there overseeing the port operations, and they have hired Blake Farenthold at about $160,000 a year to be their lobbyist.
Apparently, running a port in a small town on the Texas coast requires a lobbyist in D.C. with these sorts of connections.
whatever that means. But he's going to be lobbying, and in news reports, he is quoted as saying that he still has a good relationship with members of Congress. Now, the question for a lot of folks sitting out there is, you know, number one, when is he going to pay back the money? Governor Abbott, lots of folks have been calling on Farenthold to pay back the taxpayers for the $85,000 that he used to settle a sexual harassment lawsuit.
And to pay off for the special election that he's forced by resigning early.
Yeah, so he's cost us lots and lots of money. But we have just found out that Blake Farenthold has now decided, based on the advice of his lawyer, that, he's not going to pay back the taxpayers. After saying he would, well, first saying he wasn't, then saying he would, now he's not going to again. Members of Congress from Texas, when he comes knocking on your doors, you should not answer the door.
That's right.
I am committed to doing a regular series of open records requests to every member of the Texas delegation to Congress to find out who's meeting with the scumball.
Yeah.
It is highly inappropriate. This fellow is being paid by the taxpayers to lobby the federal government while owing us at a minimum $85,000.
That's right. You know, it's the same as it ever was. You have a congressman leave office and immediately go through the revolving door into the lobby, and not just any lobby, but tax-funded lobby. And that's enough of a problem in normal cases, but here we have a guy who's disgraced, you know, run from office and doing it nonetheless. It's got to be put to a stop. And the only way to do it is for these congressmen to say, hey, we have a standard for who we'll meet with. We're not meeting with some tax-funded lobbyist who owes the people possibly hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, and you know, here in Texas, we've had several state members of the state legislature say they're not going to meet with any tax-funded lobbyists. The least our congressional delegation can do, the least those folks who we send to Washington, D.C. could do, would be to show honor and respect to the people of Texas enough, to their employers,
right,
to not meet with someone who has bilked the taxpayers out of $85,000 to pay off a sexual harassment lawsuit.
Well, we'll have to keep an eye on it, maybe put everybody on the ducky pajama alert going forward. Thanks for your reporting on it, Michael.
Thanks, Tony.
Next, let's go down to the Bayou City to talk with Charles Blaine. There's some outcry down there in Houston over a bond package that's being put on the ballot for later this year that they're kind of rushing forward. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Tony, thanks. So they are asking the county to pass a bond on August 25th. So it's a week before Labor Day, before HISD, our biggest school district here, is back in session, you know, tail end of summer. They're asking for a $2.5 billion bond election to do some flooding projects, some loosely related to Harvey and some not related to Harvey at all.
Yeah, some of this basically coming from the county commissioners, and the billing of it is, oh, this is about Hurricane Harvey recovery. You know, this is an emergency thing. In fact, they went to the governor to get emergency authorization to have this election. But, you know, the details are pretty sketchy.
Yeah, very sketchy. And it's funny because, you know, in the letter to the governor, they kind of really played up Harvey and said that this was related to Harvey. But during the discussion at commissioner's court, they talked a lot about how, while it is somewhat related to Harvey, they're just using this money for some long-term projects that we should have had done years ago. But yeah, the details are very sketchy. We're about 100 days out and have yet to see one project proposal. The $2.5 billion number that they're throwing around is just an estimate. They don't have a hard number just yet. So it's frustrating that we're you know, going to be voting on this in three short months, and we have not seen any projects yet.
Yeah, the local Republican Party was opposing at least the timing of the election, wanting this to happen in November, basically saying, hey, we want more detail. We want to know what we're actually voting on.
Yeah, yeah, it's interesting. They had planned to do this. Some local activists here planned to bring up a proposal in Harris County Republican Party opposing that election date, and they did, and it just so happened to be the same day, just hours after the governor gave approval. So the county party gave a resounding no to the August 25th election and really sent a message saying that they want uniform election dates because, as everyone knows, no one is going to be paying attention to an election in the middle of August. And, you know, we would hope that they would place it on the ballot when more people would be paying attention and would be inclined to come out.
Yeah, I mean, it seems, and cynically so, you would think this is being designed to minimize participation in the election as people are going back to school, as they're dealing with the summer, you know, as they're not thinking about voting. There's going to be this very big election going on when it could have waited a couple months. You put it in November and you have everybody showing up to vote for Congress and everything else would have an opportunity to weigh in.
Yeah, they could have waited 7 weeks. I mean, if it was that much of an emergency, it's been nearly a year since Harvey. They could have brought it up on, you know, in the last November election. They could have brought it up in May. But no, they're bringing it up now. So if it was that much of an emergency, there's been some time to do it. So yeah, they can wait the 7 weeks till November.
Well, I appreciate your reporting on it. Keep us informed as we find out what's actually in the package, because I think we need to make sure that voters out there know what's up as the election day approaches.
Certainly will do.
Thanks, Charles.
Thank you.
Speaking of questionable bonds, let's turn to Jacob Asmussen with the Central Texas Bureau. City of Austin contemplating a big bond package that would include a lot of funding for affordable housing. Yet they're doing a ton of things to make living here very unaffordable.
That's right, Tony. They're looking at an $850 million bond for this November, and up to $300 million of that is supposed to be for affordable housing. You know, the city is throwing all of this money to fix a problem that they've created.
Yeah, so you've done a little bit of coverage about this, but there's a lot of things the city's doing to increase costs for people who want to build houses, for people who want to live their lives.
Absolutely. It's the fees and the regulations on home developers that's driving everything up. You know, recently did an article about Donovan Davis, a local architect, who said that what used to cost him $75 for a permit now costs over $2,000. And that's just one of pages and pages of regulations that home developers have to go through.
And so people who want to get a house, it's harder to build one, it's harder to renovate one, it's harder to acquire one, it's harder to do anything to move into a house in the city of Austin.
Yeah, and the problem is the fees and regulations, but the city is trying to solve it by raising taxes on people and just throwing money at affordable housing.
Yeah, which actually exacerbates the problem. We've seen a ton of these bond packages. Property taxes are already very high in the city, and from both the city and the school district and others, and now they're saying, hey, let's raise taxes even more so that we can make things affordable.
Yeah, right. You know, it's if I went into a doctor with a broken left arm and he said, all right, I'm going to fix this by amputating your left leg. Wait, what? That doesn't fix my broken arm. And that makes things worse.
Yeah, that makes things worse. So, you know, you did a really interesting article recently on events, things that are going on in the city. You know, the city of Austin, known for all of these big events, South by Southwest, ACL, those kind of things. But also small events and, you know, big kind of community activities. These are the things that draw people to the city. A lot of these people are not able to do what they used to be able to do because the city's standing in the way.
Mm, they're getting forced out. One was the Travis Country 5K race, just a local neighborhood 5K race, about 400 runners. The director of that said it cost him over $26,000 to hold this race. The prices kept going up each year, even though they didn't do anything differently. And he says now the race doesn't exist anymore. It's too expensive.
Yeah. So there goes a community event and something that actually would be good for people. Well, you know, I think we'll have to keep an eye on this bond package as it develops. I hope citizens, taxpayers stand up and say, hey, you know, don't pretend you're going to solve the affordability crisis by making things more unaffordable for homeowners. That's not a solution.
You're right.
Texas Scorecard Radio is a project of Empower Texans. At texasscorecard.com or empowertexans.com, you can find more news and daily updates from all around the Lone Star State. You can also find updates from Empower Texans and Texas Scorecard on Facebook and Twitter, and follow Empower Texans on Instagram. Texas Scorecard's news digest goes out weekly via email and monthly in print. Subscribe online and find more information at empowertexans.com. Someone's always keeping score. We think it ought to be the taxpayers.
For our interview segment this week, I wanted to sit down with Brandon Waltons, Capital Bureau Chief for Texas Scorecard, to do a deep dive on this issue of whether Democrats in Texas are going to maintain their obstructionist coalition in the Texas House. And that's all at stake in the elections and then over the next few months heading into the November election. So
right.
Thanks for coming in, Brandon, and sitting down with me to talk about this. This was spawned by some news article you did a week or so ago. This is an issue in the Democratic primary, in the runoff.
Oh, absolutely. So the impetus of this was it was a debate for a Democrat primary runoff in Austin between Cheryl Cole and this guy Cheeto Vaila, both very progressive. You know, as a conservative, when you're watching these Democrat debates, it's sort of a bizarre world thing as they all try to get to the left of each other. And
total opposite. You know, everybody in the Republican primary, you have real Republicans, you've got the rhinos, but everybody is wanting to say, hey, the next coming of Trump.
Yeah.
So over here and over on the left, it's, you know, who can be the un-Trump?
Yeah. So watched it just a little bit out of curiosity. And an interesting question was raised in the debate, which was essentially, you know, Democrats are the minority in Texas and the Texas legislature, at least right now. And how are you going to be effective as a Democrat in a Republican-led legislature? And so Cheeto Vaila gave this answer, which was essentially, you know, if we're a third of the House right now, and if we pick up seats in November, you know, it gives us 60, 65. The most important vote we as Democrats are going to take is the first vote for the Speaker, because if we can get a small faction of Republicans to coalesce and into a coalition with all the Democrats, we can basically run the table and stop whatever conservative legislation we want.
Yeah, and this is an honest assessment of things from Chito Vela. Chito Vela, a former legislative staffer running for Democrat state rep, so solidly Democratic state rep seat here in Austin.
Yes.
And you know, there's a history to this going back to 2009, where the Democrats basically positioned themselves to have a coalition with some Republicans to block out other Republicans, and then to, you know, when they can play their cards,
right,
obstruct conservative reforms.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's not the first time this has happened. I mean, this is essentially what led to Speaker Joe Strauss, who's been in office since 2009,
right,
when all
right.
this happened
yeah,
took
so,
place.
So let's do a deep dive on this. I wanted to talk about the history, how it came about in 2009, and just do a little thumbnail sketch on that, and then how we've seen this play out. And then I guess kind of explore, as we look at the field, whether we're going to see this happen again or whether you're going to see Republicans assert control of the lower chamber. So if you go back to 2009, you've had the first, I guess you even have to go before that, 2003, mm-hmm. you have Tom Craddock elected as Speaker of the House. This is the first Republican speaker in forever, basically.
Yeah.
You know, Texas had always been a Democrat state, and it was this war between the conservative Democrats and the liberal Democrats, and then you have the rise of Republicans, and statewide, Republicans win starting in the 90s, but by 2002, they finally capture control of the lower chamber of the House of Representatives, and you see a Republican majority there. I don't recall, maybe 85 seats. It was, mm-hmm. it was solid Republican majority. And so, it not really surprising, they elect this very long-serving Republican, Tom Craddock of Midland, had been in office since before man walked on the moon.
Yes,
still
yes.
in office. Had been in office.
Still in office, heading into the 86.
For 30, I guess at that point would have been about 34 years. And so he is elected Speaker of the House in 2003. Lots of conflict over the next three terms as he's trying to be knocked off that pedestal as running a Republican House, passing Republican things, tort reform, Republican redistricting bills, electric dereg, things that Republicans were in favor of that Democrats were not particularly supportive of. And so in 2007, you see him somewhat destabilized and then headed into the 2009 legislative session after the 2008 election, after the Obama wave.
Yeah.
You have a really interesting situation in the Texas House of Representatives. You have a 76-74 Republican majority.
Bare, as slim as it can get.
As slim as it can be, Republicans in control there. But of course, as we are all aware, Republicans who vote or pay attention to Republican politics, or pretty much anybody at this point, certainly after the Trump election, not all Republicans are equal, right? Not all Republicans
right.
are the same. And so there was this significant minority of Republican legislators who, you know, really didn't like passing these conservative bills under Craddock. So 11 of them got together and they cut a deal with 65, not 80, actually wasn't even all of the Democrats, but 65 of the Democrats who said, hey, our 65 plus your 11 makes 76,
yes.
makes a majority of the chamber. And so pick amongst yourselves a person who can be the speaker, and we will vote for that. The Democrats call themselves the ABCs, anybody but Craddock. Right?
Yes.
We're going to get rid of Craddock. We want to get in somebody else who will cut us a better deal. And so these 11 Republicans got together. One of those Republicans was Joe Strauss of San Antonio. He was just going into his third term.
Yeah.
As a member of the House.
Hadn't made a lot of waves when he was in the House. Yeah. Sort of you know, not one of the boisterous personalities you kind of imagine.
Yeah.
When
and
you think
he
of
still
a,
is not.
A
it is it's not a, a standout personality by any stretch. So the 11 of them get together, and for various reasons, almost as if to pick the guy with the least notability, the least notoriety, the least baggage, certainly,
right?
Because nobody knew who he was. He was a younger, you know, in only two terms at that point, or almost even, not even a full two terms. They pick Joe Strauss. They come out and they say, hey, we've cut this deal with the Democrats, and we're going to put in a speaker. And they succeeded in that. That first term, you see 50-50 split of
yes.
chairmanships. And then from then on, so they put in a speaker and have a coalition. It's 50-50 split Democrats and Republicans. Well, what happens in 2010?
Well, you've got, once again, you know, Joe Strauss got a speaker's race. You've got more Republicans in the House.
You see the Tea Party wave.
Yeah.
So you see this election happen where you go from having a 76-74 situation where, okay, maybe it makes sense to have a bipartisan coalition running the House, to 102, 103 Republicans?
A lot more Republicans. And so you think, okay, now the tables are reset. You know, now we can look and see what kind of speaker actually represents a House that's controlled two-thirds by Republicans. It's not how it happens.
But nonetheless, the Democrats, even with their small numbers, continue to partnership with that existing group, and they say, we're going to keep this situation going. We're going to keep the Democratic committee chairs. We're going to keep the Democrats on the calendars committee, which kind of decides what bills get to go to the floor and which ones don't. We're going to do all these things. And you've seen this session after session after session, 2011, 2013, yes, 2015, 2017. The Republican numbers have gone down a little. 95?
Yeah, but always sort of hovered around two-thirds.
Always close to two-thirds, yet nonetheless, you still have Democrats in a power position. And the most conservative reps, like those who have formed the Freedom Caucus, completely blocked out from electing from passing legislation. So what we're hearing at this thing is basically the Democrats want to maintain this situation. How can they partner with a group of the Republicans to be in an effective majority in the House and to put the most conservative reps in a minority position? That's what they're talking about.
Yes, exactly. And they've been successful at it for the last, you know, decade.
So let's talk about the dynamics of where we're at. Got a few minutes to run through some of the candidates in the situation. Are they going to be able to do this again? And I think it's an open question. I think it's an open question. It's up to the Republican members of the House and to their constituents to see what the constituents demand.
Exactly. And so after the Strauss regime passed the sessions that Strauss was the speaker, obviously conservatives, you know, grassroots conservatives put a lot of pressure on their representatives, and it sort of built up a big movement led by the Freedom Caucus to change the Republican caucus rules. So that the Republican caucus essentially, and it's a flawed process, and I won't get into the details of it. The idea is that the Republican caucus itself should vote amongst themselves to pick a speaker that they will all go and vote against, and essentially have a unified Republican candidate. That way the speaker is someone picked by the Republicans, sort of middle of the Republican
pack. Loyal to, you know, the thought here is any speaker is going to be loyal to the base that elects him. So if a group of Democrats and a group of Republicans elect a speaker, you're going to see that speaker be loyal to that group. Here we have the Republican caucus saying, hey, we want to get together and we want to pick a speaker, whoever that speaker is, but he's going to be somebody we elect, and the Democrats are going to just have to accept it. And that's going to allow us to, you know, effectively run the House as a Republican House. Joe Strauss bows out as Speaker after this decision is made?
Almost immediately, like concurrently with this decision being made by the Republican caucus, Joe Strauss decides it's time for him to retire. And we see some other members, State Representative Byron Cook and some others kind of bow out around that time as well. Now, the problem, of course, is that, you know, you can't force them. I mean, these are representatives. They ultimately can vote for whoever they want to for a speaker. I mean, you can't force that. That's in the rules of the House. And so the Republican Party of Texas, ahead of the primary elections, had a pledge form. Essentially, will you support the nominee that is picked by the Republican caucus? And candidates and incumbents were able to fill that out. The Republican Party of Texas published that on their website. Very helpful for primary voters to kind of know where their representatives stand. There's a number of people who failed to ever sign that pledge, and essentially their votes are, you know, up for grabs. We don't know.
So we've got a few candidates: Phil King, Tan Parker, John Zerwa, several state reps who are out, a bunch of others that are kind of talked about as potentially running. But you're seeing them split out into basically these two groups: the ones who've signed the pledge, who have the get elected by Republicans path.
Right.
And the ones who don't sign the pledge, who have the I'm going to go to the Democrats first and pick up some Republicans path. And it's an open question of which we'll see win this fight.
Yes, exactly. And so you're right. You named them off. We've got Phil King, Tan Parker, John Zerwas. These are the people who have announced, even a Democrat, Eric Johnson. What's more interesting is the people who are sort of working it behind the scenes right now that haven't come out and announced, but are kind of capital sources and people in there have kind of told us they're out there really working behind the scenes with members to try to maybe recreate this coalition. Those are people like State Representative Drew Darby and Travis Clardy.
Yeah.
Others.
Well, I think it's really interesting that this is so open. It's popping up in the Democratic primary, in this Democratic primary, as you wrote about. And I think what we're going to have to do is just keep an eye on it and keep talking about who these candidates are and what overtures they're making to the Democrats, whether they're trying to court the Democrats or whether they're going to go the path and try and elect a Republican.
Absolutely. And if there's one thing we've learned from the Strauss era, it's that once this coalition is put into power, it's very, very difficult to wind back.
Yeah, really high stakes. Appreciate you joining me today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks. Next up, Carrie Cheshire takes on the Houston Chronicle and illegal immigration in this week's commentary.
In Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, one star-crossed lover famously asks, "What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other word would smell as sweet." But as Juliet would learn, names, terms, and definitions did matter a lot back then, and they still do today. With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Carrie Cheshire, Vice President of Texans for Fiscal Responsibility. Recently, the Houston Chronicle published an op-ed titled, "I'm a Texan, Ken Paxton Wants to Deport Me," written by illegal immigrant and dreamer activist Damaris Gonzalez. Published on Twitter, I quote tweeted the article and said, "You aren't a Texan and you aren't a Houstonian. You're a foreign national and an illegal immigrant, and the Chronicle should have identified you as such." This action prompted a Twitter firestorm from all sorts of folks who both shared and disagreed with my position. Ultimately, one of the Chronicle's editors asked me to submit a letter to the editor, to his publication, defending the crazy idea that U.S. citizenship is necessary to be a Texan. In the submission, which was heavily redacted and published by the Chronicle, and is published in full by Texas Scorecard, I said that I was shocked and appalled, but unfortunately not surprised, that the Houston Chronicle would choose to run such a salacious article from a foreign alien intent on undermining our nation and the rule of law. Despite her claims, Ms. Gonzalez is certainly not a Texan. She's an illegal immigrant who was illegally granted a temporary relief from deportation proceedings by the Obama administration in 2012 through the unconstitutional DACA program. But simply because she has resided illegally in Lone Star State doesn't mean she has a right to continue to do so. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has challenged DACA in court, upsetting liberal activists, including Gonzalez, who ambushed him in a restaurant last year, and berated him for asking the federal government to follow existing immigration law. Paxton was cordial with her, but firm in his position that the federal government should either follow the law or change it. But because he hasn't kowtowed to her and other liberal activists, Gonzalez now states, quote, "Paxton has made it his personal mission to make my life hell." Such a statement is absurd, and it's beneath the dignity of even the Hillary Clinton-endorsing Houston Chronicle to print. I sincerely hope the editors don't actually believe that, though it would perhaps explain why their paper is hemorrhaging readers each and every day. Indeed, I suggest that the newspaper's editors and writers spend more time among regular, everyday Texans. They'll find they're normal, hardworking people who are offended that those with no legal right to be here are allowed to chant "here to stay" in public forums and the public square with no fear of deportation. They'll find that everyday Texans believe the rule of law matters and that America should have a border just like every other nation on earth. I don't know for certain if Ken Paxton wants Ms. Gonzalez deported, but I certainly do, and millions of Texans and Americans do too. Citizenship means something, and there's a process to go about earning it for those not born with the blood right. Ms. Gonzalez hasn't followed this process, and thus, she isn't a citizen. But citizenship doesn't only convey a right to be here. Indeed, it conveys a responsibility to keep here, here. As Benjamin Franklin famously said, we are to have a republic only, quote, if we can keep it. Indeed, it's incumbent on all of us each day to remember that in the United States of America, and in the great state of Texas, we the people are the sovereigns, and that holding government to its constitutional constraints is up to us. With this week's Texas Scorecard Radio commentary, I'm Carrie Cheshire.
That's a wrap for this week. Thanks for listening.
Texas Scorecard Radio is brought to you each week as a public service from the Empower Texans Foundation and in partnership with the Lincoln Institute and this station. You can download podcasts from each program and learn more at empowertexans.com.